Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war at the moment, one of the most important battlefronts, of course, is the COVID-19 virus. It has been afflicting our country for over 2 years now. It has done so with devastating effects on our people, on our health, most obviously, but also on our society and even on our freedoms. And it has proven to be, I think it's fair to say, the bane of our existence at this moment and probably for the foreseeable future. We have heroes in this war, however, and I am very grateful that we have one of them with us at the moment. His name is Dr. Peter McCullough. He has more acronyms after his name than you can shake a stick at, because he has been credentialed and is highly acclaimed as an internist, cardiologist, an epidemiologist, and a man specializing in cardiovascular complications of viral infections and the other injuries caused by the COVID-19 virus. He has emerged as one of the leaders of a group of medical professionals who have stood up and disputed authoritatively the sorts of things we have been told now for quite some time by the public health authorities of our country, politicians, and the media. Among other things, Dr. McCullough has contributed mightily to a guide I want to commend highly to everyone. It's entitled A Guide to Home-Based COVID Treatment, Step by Step Doctor's Plan That Could Save Your Life. Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate what you are doing, the leadership you have exhibited, and not least the courage, as I say, that you have displayed now for months and months and months, both individually and together with colleagues. And I think it has been a profoundly important service to our country. And let me just say, as one American, it's deeply appreciated, sir. And I hope you will keep it up. And thank you for coming aboard to talk with us a little bit about it all.
Well, thanks for having me.
I thought we'd break this up, and I appreciate you giving us the better part of your hour, into three distinct sections, if I may. The first is, where are we at the moment on COVID-19? The second will be on how did we get into this fix, and what should we be doing about it now? So how would you describe the state of our, well, health and our nation, really, 2 years on in this pandemic? I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus, but formerly known as COVID-19.
We're currently in the Omicron outbreak, which is the far and away the largest and most intense outbreak that we've had. It's probably double or nearly triple the size of any prior outbreak we've had either before or after the mass vaccination program. So what we know is that the Omicron outbreak is, it looks like it's going to be brief but intense. Like I say, we have far more now people with COVID right now than any point in time in the pandemic, but it's a very mild syndrome, much like a common cold or less than a common cold. Individuals don't need prescription treatment. They don't have significant risks of hospitalization. It's free of pulmonary involvement. It's by and large now like having a common cold. And so we anticipate that this outbreak will delay the opening of schools for a few weeks, which it has. But beyond that, won't have a significant impact. I don't think we're getting trustable data on hospitalizations. I haven't been convinced that that we can really get a read on what's going on in the hospitals. I know we certainly have a deluge of patients with COVID-19 in practice right now. And it's honestly like fielding calls for minor head colds.
That's encouraging, especially because we're told that this relatively mild variant of the disease may impart at last the kind of herd immunity that we've been told is really the only long-term solution to this disease. Would you say that's in prospect now? And if so, would that in fact get us out of the woods at last?
There is one paper by first author Khan and colleagues demonstrating that, immunity to Omicron in a sense, confers back immunity to Delta, and that looks reassuring. Clearly, Omicron immunity gives immunity to further Omicron infections, and so we still have a tail of Delta, which was a much more difficult and serious outbreak. So if we can, in fact, close out immunity and close out the Delta pandemic with Omicron, now the next question is, where do we go from here? The wild card in the whole pandemic outlook is mass vaccination, because mass vaccination has given a large number of people very narrow, incomplete, and short-lasting immunity. So everybody's on different stages of having this vaccine immunity. Some have had the vaccine, and then they've had one of the more lethal variants, wild-type alpha, beta, gamma, delta. So the vaccines didn't provide very good protection. So some now have rock solid, durable immunity there, but they can still pick up Omicron and have a mild case. There are some who are vaccinated who never came in contact with COVID-19. And now, in a sense, the vaccines for them have expired. So they're effectively uncovered. Others have had vaccines, and they're relatively contemporary, and now they're getting Omicron anyway, since the vaccines don't cover Omicron, and now they're conferring immunity. So the vaccines have created so many different patient groups. It's hard to know. The great concern is that they'll spur yet another hyperdominant variant that will come into, you know, existence and then start to dominate the news cycles again.
So I've been told by one of your colleagues, I think it was Dr. Robert Malone, that trying to use a leaky vaccine in the middle of a pandemic is a formula for creating more and probably much more deadly strains of this thing. Is that essentially what you've just said?
No, I think it's theoretically possible to have more deadly strains. And I think when all the statistics are tallied, I think Delta will be probably the most deadly strain, just because I think it was so contagious and it was so pervasive. But with Omicron, which is far and away producing the most number of cases, it's definitely the mildest strain. We're not having anybody come close to needing the hospital. It's honestly just like a mild cold.
And yet we're hearing endlessly reported by the media and to some extent by the CDC and I think NIH, that we're seeing these huge surges in hospitalizations associated with Omicron, the COVID-19, you know, variant du jour. Is that inaccurate, or is that misrepresenting the data?
Our government agencies have a full U.S. hospital census. So there's 5,600 hospitals in the United States, 2,200 acute care hospitals, and none of them have any handle on, you know, the real-time number of admissions and patients in the hospital with COVID-19, the respiratory illness. So I think there's a lot of estimates going on. There are some hospital reporting networks that the CDC uses as a proxy. But one of the important points is that these hospitalizations are not adjudicated. And due to the massive overuse of testing for all types of conditions, COVID, I think what we're doing is we're just generating lots of test positive results without any certainty on the hospitalization. So I don't think any of the hospitalized data that I've seen, we'll have to wait for it to get to the peer-reviewed stage and see if these hospitalizations have been adjudicated. I just don't think they're trustworthy.
And then there is this problem, as you know, Dr. McCullough, that people are assigned COVID as the cause of, well, their hospitalization or perhaps even their death, when it isn't actually the case that that was the reason for one of those things to have happened. Is that a endemic problem at the moment in this data? And how has it contributed to this sort of, well, fear porn, I guess is a term that's been coined for it, to sort of terrorize Americans into believing that this is, the Omicron specifically is far worse than it actually is?
It's due to a lot of off-label testing. You know, the tests are only approved for, as a diagnostic aid for acute respiratory COVID-19. They should only be strictly used in sick patients who have the acute respiratory illness. They're trying to figure out if it's flu or another cause. That should be the only use of tests. And I think since COVID-19 is such a serious diagnosis, that the PCR tests really should be limited to those with cycle thresholds of 28 and below. So there shouldn't be a single patient diagnosed with a PCR test with a cycle threshold over 28 as a standalone test and then be declared having COVID. That shouldn't happen anymore. And I think it's, I think it's rampant, honestly, that testing is being done across so many different patient groups, and with Omicron just being so prevalent that we're just having a blow up of test positive reports, and we can't possibly figure out who has respiratory COVID and who doesn't.
If you wouldn't mind just drilling down on that point you've just made in layman's language, it would be appreciated, because I've been told that if you do more cycles in these sorts of tests, that you can get any result you want. That, you know, they're not designed to be tested 45 times, for example, or cycled 45 times, that you'll get fragments of things that aren't actually operating in your body. Is that roughly correct?
Well, it's been found that the primers that the PCR use, which is a small sets of base pairs for the spike protein, the nucleocapsid, the envelope protein, the polymerase, and another region called ORFB, that these primers have some homology with other cells in the nasopharynx, from whether they be other organisms or, you know, human RNA, and that if the cycler just keeps cycling and cycling and cycling, sooner or later, just by luck, one of these will turn positive. That's the reason why we want to keep the cycle thresholds 28 or below. We want to follow the CDC guidance. I think any test or hospital that's not following the CDC guidance, I don't think their hospitalization data should be trusted, and they should only be testing those acutely ill with respiratory condition. And I think at this point in time, it's so serious, they should have confirmatory testing. That is, if they are PCR positive, they should have an antigen test against the nucleocapsid and be positive there. This ought to be a very serious diagnosis, because people are put into isolation. You know, mortalities are counted. And I think if we had a strict approach to diagnosis of COVID, the case counts would come way, way down. And we'd realize that all this testing is just a set of over-testing. I see it every day in my practice. I'll tell patients, listen, unless you're really acutely ill with respiratory illness, no test. I had a patient today who got over it. She goes, well, I'm going to get another test. And I said, why? I said, you're going to be intermittently test positive for months now. I said, we got to shut down all these extra tests. All it's doing is generating, more and more cases and creating these case numbers that are through the roof. And we're not getting any clarity on what's going on in the pandemic. I think that's where we have it. We certainly can't rely on any reports on hospitalization. That's for sure.
This is so profoundly troubling, because when you combine all of that with reports that hospitals, doctors are being incentivized to diagnose patients as having COVID, that there's actually a premium being paid for COVID, treatments, all of this is being skewed, it seems, in a way that has further exacerbated one of the fallouts of all of this, it seems to me, which is a discrediting of our public health authorities, for that matter, politicians, of course, the media, even the Supreme Court now seemingly is getting all kinds of garbage information about what actually is the state of this disease, which is why I come back, sir, if I may, to this threshold question. We've had something on the order of 860,000 Americans killed, we're told, by COVID, and millions more elsewhere around the world. We've had these VAERS data developed with respect to the vaccines, which we're told are off by a factor of 40, according to one recent study, so that it's not just a million people who have been adversely affected, but some number greatly larger than that. Our economy has been devastated. Our society, as I said at the outset, traumatized, and our freedoms. And I guess the question that I want to come to you most directly about is, you have been a leader in championing the idea of a different approach to this disease from the get-go, namely therapy use, treating the disease, not using vaccines as the sole method of treatment, or worse, I guess, perhaps remdesivir, which it seems is a formula for killing people rather than saving their lives. Talk us through that, if you would, the therapies and why we are not using them.
You know, it turned out that the hospital was a very disadvantaged place to start treatment for patients with COVID-19. And I think partly because by the time people go to the hospital, the viral replication phase of the illness is just about done. So, it's a hopeless for remdesivir. It's relatively hopeless for other antivirals. And by that time, the inflammatory pattern and coagulation is so sufficiently advanced, it's actually relatively hopeless for, steroids, anti-inflammatories, and anticoagulants. So the treatment window is really in the first few days of illness. In a recent paper by Fazio and colleagues, of which I'm one of the authors, we found the first 3 days is really the golden time period. After that, we lose control over the syndrome. So it's relatively irrelevant whether it's remdesivir or mechanical ventilator or no mechanical ventilator. The hospital is just too late to do anything. It's all about early treatment.
So, Dr. Peter McCullough, when you talk about the first 3 days being the golden zone, you may not actually know you have the disease by that point. Are there things that you're recommending people do if they are simply manifesting some of the symptoms associated with COVID to get on to a course of treatment? And how would they go about doing that?
Well, most of this is now historical because Omicron doesn't require prescription treatment by and large. But people really need to go to high-quality centers that are doing same-day testing. It's unacceptable to wait 3 days for a test. And so many people are getting tests, and they're waiting 2 or 3 days and getting the cycle threshold of greater than 45 on a test. It's basically a worthless test. We can't tell if they have COVID or not. So they really need to go for...
But the test will say they do. That's the problem, isn't it? You cycle, as we talked about a moment ago, 45 times. You're likely to get a positive result. It's just sort of axiomatic.
No, but I'm just saying it's the diagnostic.
They may not actually have it. It's your point. I got it.
So people really need to get same-day testing. And no, COVID-19 should not be a surprise to anybody on this call. So no one should be scrambling at this point in time. They should know the urgent care or hospital system that does high quality testing, keeps that PCR threshold at 28 or below. They know where to go. They know how long it takes the test to come back. There should be absolutely no surprises at all. I think they should get a confirmatory antigen test as well, and just demand that they need that they get both, so you know if you have COVID or not. And I think that would be first and foremost. The second is to, once you have the diagnosis in the first 3 days with the Omicron variant, the main intervention is actually nasal and oral washes with dilute povidone iodine. So you buy a 10% povidone iodine bottle at Amazon or any other online retailer for about $5, and take that and dilute it 10 to 1, which would be half a teaspoon in a shot glass of water, and then a bulb syringe or spray bottle, and over the sink, spray it up into the nostrils and sniff it back to the point it was in the back of the throat, and then spit it out. Do that twice on both sides. That effectively kills the virus up in the nasal cavity, and it'll shut off the infection in the vast majority of cases, to where literally people start to feel better within a matter of hours, because it's basically a virus of the nasal cavity. And another one of the big mistakes is you have a virus of the nasal cavity and everybody's reaching for an IV, or they're reaching for a pill, or they're reaching for something else. And wait a minute, you have a virus replicating up in your nasal cavity. Just kill the virus in the nasal cavity. Yeah. And so povidone iodine, 12 clinical studies, overwhelmingly positive. I think over 70% impact early on, doing nothing else with that approach. And if iodine can't be tolerated, then it would be a dilute hydrogen peroxide that would be basically a 3-to-1 dilution of hydrogen peroxide, and that can be used as well. I mean, I just got a whole flurry of Omicron calls on the way home from the hospital today, and each one of them I said, listen, start the nasal washes. And it's amazing how many people say, oh, where do I get this? How do I find it? It's like, you know, we're 2 years into this. We've messaged this as hard as we possibly can. Every early treatment website messages this. There should not be a fire drill at this point in time. Everybody should have their home kit. So they should have this. So either povidone iodine or hydrogen peroxide. They should have zinc, 50 milligrams of elemental zinc. They should have vitamin D, 5,000 units of international units of vitamin D for prevention. And we go to 20,000 units with treatment. Vitamin C, 3,000 milligrams a day for treatment. We use quercetin, 500 milligrams twice a day for treatment. And then we add an over-the-counter antacid medicine called famotidine or Pepcid, 80 milligrams a day. And that's really our drug that impairs viral replication. So by killing the virus at the source and then just providing some additional supplements that reduce viral replication, predominantly the zinc and the famotidine, we largely have shut it off. So I can tell you the early prescribing doctors now are using very little or no hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. Now, it's basically an over-the-counter managed illness. And there may be some sicker patients. I haven't ruled this out. You know, a few weeks ago when we couldn't tell if it was Delta or Omicron, I had some older seniors that were sicker, and I referred them for a monoclonal antibody infusion using the GSK Sotrovimab product, a 500 milligrams IV infusion that worked great. That's the infusion now, the only one that is believed to be effective against Omicron. There could be a severe case. I'm not saying there won't be. And then we have had cases where there is some kind of rapid early pulmonary involvement, and they've responded well to the combined use of prednisone and ivermectin, weight-based ivermectin. And because the virus is replicating so quickly, we need to use 600 micrograms per kilogram body weight. Now, we always do other things. For instance, we know the spike protein is thrombogenic, so everybody gets aspirin, 325 milligrams a day. We can always use inhaled budesonide, oral prednisone. High-risk people who are going to be in bed for a while, we use blood thinners. But since Omicron is so much different than the prior variants, and it's now the vast majority of everything we see in practice is Omicron, our treatment algorithm has changed. The impetus for testing has changed. You know, a lot of people now have just given up on testing and said, listen, it's like a cold. You're going to use over-the-counter things anyway. You know, why do we really need to make a big deal over testing? And then there was almost complete capitulation by a couple of the health systems last week. And I saw the memos that came out that said, listen, if you're at home, you're a healthcare worker and you're at home and you have COVID anyway, just come on into work if you have mild symptoms. So it's almost like, you know, it's complete capitulation. And those same health systems a few weeks ago were going to, you know, be trying to demand vaccination to have a squeaky clean workplace. And here they're just inviting people with active COVID back into the workplace just because of sheer desperation for workers, basically.
Well, and an appreciation that the problem is manageable, I take it. But doctor, let me just ask you, because one of the key things that has been so exemplary, as far as I'm concerned, about what you and colleagues have done, notably with your guide to home-based COVID treatment, is that you have put forward very aggressively this idea that we can treat this disease, and especially this version that has relatively modest repercussions. You are still facing, are you not, and are the body of medical professionals with whom you're associated, are you not still being actively suppressed by the medical profession writ large and you know, the public health authorities, Tony Fauci among them? Isn't this still going on, that they're trying to deny people the kind of information that you say is now available and widely accepted as valid, at least among the circle that is successfully treating this disease, as you are?
Well, where we are is that the American Medical Association did announce a campaign in early in September to abolish the use of ivermectin, abolish it. And American Medical Association is not a treating organization. They don't have clinical competencies. They don't have clinical practice guidelines. They're a doctor's political action committee. So they're way out of their character by trying to abolish the use of ivermectin. People would have to ask the question, why? I mean, there's 63 supportive studies, over 30 random. This is first line in Mexico, India, Japan, elsewhere. It's been widely used in the United States for a year, very successfully, the COVID-19. Why would the AMA want to abolish it? Well, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, a organization that supports ivermectin use, sent over a cease and desist letter to the AMA to ask them to stop disseminating misinformation about ivermectin. I mean, they were saying that ivermectin has no therapeutic role. And so, so the AMA is openly trying to suppress the use of ivermectin. The NIH and the CDC have had tweets and advertisements saying that ivermectin is only a horse dewormer. So I think they've been pretty active. The first year of the pandemic was the year of hydroxychloroquine. It was used widely, very successfully. And the FDA and then the medical establishment basically came out with a narrative that said hydroxychloroquine didn't work. And it was more and more studies that piled on. We're over 300 studies of hydroxychloroquine in its first line in Eastern Europe, its first line in so many places all over the world, many states in India, Russia, that first line in Africa, there was a narrative, and it was largely driven by, and again, I think the American Medical Association did have a negative statement on hydroxychloroquine, the FDA. And, I think if those bodies had their way, I don't think anybody would be treated with anything for COVID-19 because it's not like they suggest any alternative.
But this brings us to the larger question, sir. As I understand it, the reason they had to say these sorts of things about therapies like those you've mentioned is if they were going to proceed with emergency use authorization for these substantially untested vaccines, which are really not vaccines, they're gene therapies, they had to say that there were no alternatives, did they not? Is that not kind of how we got into this fix in the first place? And was it Big Pharma? Was it Tony Fauci? Was it the CDC? Where does the blame lie for that wrong diagnosis, shall we say?
I've never really subscribed to that idea of blame the EUA legislation for this. Remember that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are clinically appropriate off-label use of drugs with an indication they're being used for is for the active treatment of COVID-19. Vaccines are experimental investigational agents, not FDA approved, and they have the indication to prevent the binary occurrence of COVID-19, the illness. So I think the indications are completely different. And I don't think it's the EUA mechanism that's really the driver here. If you look at the AMA statements and the NIH and the CDC and then the FDA statements on vaccination, it is a full-throated endorsement. So while these agencies absolutely, positively have, they want to abolish the use of a drug, at the same time, they want to absolutely promote the use of a vaccine in every single person. So the two are absolutely linked. So the same reason why the AMA would want to abolish the use of ivermectin is, I think, the same reason why the AMA wants to strongly promote vaccination in every single human being. I think the two things are the same.
Well, I may be putting it differently or inaccurately at any rate, but that's the point I'm trying to get at. Promoting the vaccines required suppressing the therapies. And that's how we have found ourselves with the outliers like you being attacked and suppressed wherever possible, accused of disinforming the public and so on, when what you have been doing is data-based, scientifically sound, and saving people's lives. And the question of how many lives have been needlessly lost, I mean, correcting for the number that weren't actually COVID deaths, that's another calculation here. But it does seem as though there has been a horrific number of people who needlessly suffered as a result of not being able to get early treatment and being condemned to ventilators and, hospitalization and all that flowed from that. Just not good.
Well, people are angry. I think the word is out that, when they see others being treated and having good outcomes and they wonder why their doctor won't provide them early treatment and why there's never been a full-throated endorsement by our agencies to endorse doctors to do everything they can to treat COVID-19 patients. I think we have to ask ourselves, why? Why have we not had the endorsement of the government for doctors to treat patients with COVID-19 with every possible tool they can imagine or they can use in their practice?
Well, it is the question on my mind. Is there an answer in yours?
Yeah, we'd have to ask one of those officials. We'd have to ask them. I think the mistake they think is they think, well, if we endorse early treatment, then we need to tell doctors what drugs to use. But no, they don't. Well, that's up to the doctors to figure out. None of those government officials are anywhere near the competency of a treating doctor. So we're not looking to a government official to tell us what drugs to use, but we want to hear their endorsement for doctors to do everything humanly possible in early treatment. I think it's that lack of endorsement which has really stunted the use of monoclonal antibodies. Now, those are fully EUA approved. So there's never any billboards for monoclonal antibodies, never any public service announcements. There's never any reporting. So for instance, wouldn't we want to hear about bona fide hospitalizations according to who received monoclonal antibodies and who didn't? Wouldn't that tell us the treatment? Wouldn't that tell us the treatment gap? I mean, the Sotrovimab, the GSK monoclonal antibody in randomized trials, has an 85% reduction in hospitalization and death. I think every hospitalization of adults in the United States should be reported according to did they get a monoclonal antibody or not, because that would give us an actionable statistic.
Great idea. And where are we on monoclonal antibodies? Is it the case that they're now running out, that there simply aren't sufficient quantities of these? And shouldn't that be something that we're using the Defense Production Act or some technique to ensure is rectified immediately?
Well, it's completely inadequate. You know, the GSK monoclonal antibody, which is the one we want, and that 500 milligram infusion can be done all the way down to age 12. So this would be perfect with children with cystic fibrosis and severe asthma. I mean, we need this monoclonal antibody. It's been EUA approved since May. And every single nursing home should be outfitted with it, every single major ER and urgent care, no signs of it.
But why is that, sir? Is it because there's not production? Is it because there's not the endorsement? Is it because there's a lack of awareness that it's needed? How could that?
We've heard no report from our agencies. None. There's no credible report out. What's wrong with the monoclonals? Where are they? Just when we need them, where are they?
There seems, if I can suggest a theory here, that if Big Pharma's for it, these agencies are for it. If Big Pharma's against it, then they are pretty much actively suppressing it or lowballing its value or what have you. Is monoclonal antibody not something Big Pharma has a piece of? Are they not likely to benefit from
it? It's as Big Pharma as you can get.
And that's what I thought.
It's way more high tech than the vaccines. Technology in the vaccines. So, you know, there should be no hesitation at all about monoclonal antibodies. I mean, this is the dream. And these products really work. I've been using them for a year now. I am telling you that they absolutely positively work.
That is very exciting. I'm just struck by this. If indeed Big Pharma would benefit from it, is it that they won't benefit from it as much as if everybody has to get a vaccination or a umpteenth booster or remdesivir or some other expensive treatment using, you know, the gene therapy model?
Well, we have the Merck drug. That drug looks like it's definitely effective. And it's a combination of a novel kinase-like-3 inhibitor and ritonavir, an older protease inhibitor. It's kind of clunky. You have to give several pills in the morning, several pills in the evening. And then we have the Merck drug, molnupiravir. Same thing. It's kind of dosing is kind of clunky. And that's less effective. But the Pfizer drug is 80% or greater effective in reducing hospitalization and death. Merck is 30%. And these have been EUA approved. Where are they? Where's the distribution? Where's the speed that we saw with the vaccines? Boy, as soon as the vaccines were approved, you know, we saw men with refrigerated trucks and people are on the side of the road and people are cheering. And it was the biggest darn thing to roll out the vaccines. Now, here we have some drugs and monoclonal antibodies, which are, you know, available to see sick patients. We hear nothing about the rollout. We hear nothing about excitement or enthusiasm, nothing. I mean, it is absolutely stunning. So it's almost as if it's a vaccine first type of public health program and everything else is a distant second.
You feature prominently, Dr. Peter McCullough, in Robert F. Kennedy's Jr.'s new book about Dr. Anthony Fauci. And I just have to ask you about his role in all of this as best you can reconstruct it. Going back to the gain of function experimentation that he supported in the lab where we think this disease emanated from, somehow by accident or by design. When you look at Fauci's role, though, it would have been bad enough if it stopped at not owning up to what he knew about what was going on in that laboratory, with all of the implications that that had for, you know, responding appropriately to this disease, as opposed to thinking that maybe it did come out of some sort of natural evolution. But I would ask you, what is your take as a treating physician, as I think you describe them, of the kind of role that has been accorded a man who is not a treating physician, hasn't, I think, ever been, certainly hasn't been in many, many decades, and his performance in that role?
I think that person and just others involved are just a product of just very bad organizational pandemic leadership. You know, the pandemic has had four pillars of its response. First is to try to reduce the spread of illness. And I taught Americans about this when I testified in the U.S. Senate for Majority Chairman Leader Senator Ron Johnson for the Government Affairs and Homeland Security. So the first pillar is reduce the spread of illness. We needed a team of expert doctors in there, probably about eight, working on reducing the spread of illness. They would have ultimately arrived at using the oral and nasal virucidal washes. Instead, we never had a team, and all we had was just kind of perseveration on masks that didn't work and hand sanitizer. It's not a hand infection. I mean, the efforts to reduce the spread of the illness were basically ridiculous, and we never really came up with any. So yesterday, we're at our peak of Omicron cases in the United States, and we are talking massive numbers of COVID, way more than we've ever had before. And all the football stadiums are open, wide open, and people are, you know, I went to an NFL game yesterday, 100,000 people in the stadium. Nobody's wearing masks. I mean, basically, people know that either they're going to get COVID or they're not, and the measures that our government agency put out are a joke. So that was the first mistake, is not having a team of doctors on reducing the spread of illness. And then the second mistake is not to have a team of doctors on early treatment, because early treatment's the only way to reduce the spread of illness, because we reduce the infectivity period and we reduce the risk of hospitalization and death. So far and away, early treatment be the most important group. There never was a group convened on early treatment. Then we needed a group on hospital treatment. And do you know, to this day, the hospital protocols have not advanced. There's a paper by Christine Burns and JAMA from the Academy Group. She's concluded that all the hospital protocols are not trustworthy because they don't, you know, explain what the risks and benefits of the drugs are. They don't commit to scientific review or external expert review. I mean, the hospital treatments have been so disappointing, and we never see any updates on them. And then the fourth group of doctors should have been focused on vaccination. I think vaccination should have been considered for our high-risk seniors and nursing home, maybe nursing home workers, but that's about it. But since we didn't have, I mean, I'm thinking eight doctors on each group. I'm thinking 32 doctors giving out reports in four groups each month to the country. Since we didn't have that level of leadership and organization, we ended up with just a mess. We have some low-level people from the NIH and CDC trying to report to us. None of them are very high-ranking doctors in any way. And then there's just now been a perseveration on those doctors. There's been a hyper-focus on those doctors. And Scott Atlas, in his book, he's worked with them side by side. He's pretty candid about it. They're just incompetent. We are hyper-focusing on a few very incompetent, relatively small doctors in small roles.
That is about as powerful an indictment as one could have. And I think it's accurate and deeply worrying that there has been no corrective to it, even 2 years into this thing. Which brings me to my last question of you, Dr. Peter McCullough. Recap for us quickly, if you would, what we should be doing now. And let me just put it this way to you. Is insisting that everyone be vaccinated with one of these three vaccines and or boosters on top of those the priority to deal with this pandemic or endemic or a mild variant, as the case may be.
You know, I'm checking the CDC CAS system, which is actually very accurate. They have us through the week of January 8th, and I recognize we're on January 17th now, but at January 8th, they have us at 98.3% Omicron, and its clinical syndrome now is well defined. We have data from Hansen from Denmark and from the UK Public Health Security Report demonstrating the vaccines have zero effectiveness against Omicron. Zero. So I think at this point in time, we go ahead and drop all the vaccine mandates. We can make things very easy for the Supreme Court and the Biden administration. And then we pull the vaccines off the market. Pfizer, J&J, and Moderna, pull them. Take them off the market. Do a review on safety. Figure out what went wrong. Why did they fail against the variants? And then if an occasional sick Omicron patient comes up, we'll treat them. They're assuming they're very treatment responsive. And then we go back to normal now. We can stop all the emergency measures, stop all the masks, lockdown, social distancing, stop all of it. Just return to normal now.
We're witnessing something very different than that going on in communist China at the moment. I wanted to ask you about this too, if I may. Government there is locked down in the most aggressive and oppressive way imaginable. At last count, I heard over 65 million people, all aimed at trying to prevent this disease from migrating to Beijing. There's now a report that they've had at least one case of Omicron in Beijing. What are they contending with, do you think, other than trying desperately to make sure that nothing screws up the Olympic Games? Is there some new, more deadly variant of this disease? You said Delta was as deadly as we've seen so far, but do you think that that's what's now in prospect? And would that alter your recommendations about getting back to life as normal?
I don't know. I just don't think the Chinese have been trustable in terms of sources of information.
That's an understatement, sir.
They just haven't. So it's hard to know if they're dealing with Omicron, if they've got a newer variant on their hands. You know, it's only time is going to tell. We're combing the reports all over the world, you know, just waiting for the next shoe to drop, because the vaccines just keep promoting the hyperdominance of a variant. I mean, I'm looking at the CDC report. I think it's stunning how the vaccines basically prompted the hyperdominance of Delta, which we suffered with, you know, basically from early summer all the way through early fall. And now basically in a month have had a wholesale replacement of Delta, which was going strong with Omicron. I mean, what's to say that we're not going to have the wholesale replacement with yet another variant after this? The big difference is that Omicron is so much less invasive. It replicates 70 times faster in the nose than Delta, and it closes the immunologic door in Delta. So, you know, Omicron is a different syndrome, and it's basically a stuffy nose. We're just going to have to get to the point. I just think when there's this realization that we're not even reaching for mild prescription drugs, we're just telling people to get some over-the-counter cold remedies, that at that point in time, it's just hard to generate a ton of excitement. And so, you know, time will tell. We only have, I think, about 2 weeks left in our Omicron peak. So we'll know the answer in about 2 weeks. So we have me on in about 2 weeks. And now if we, you know, one of the physicians at Mass General came out and said, listen, this is it. This is the end. This is the finality. This is like going to the fireworks. And at the very end, you know, you have all the fireworks go off at once. And that this is it. And then after this, there's just not going to be anything to talk about. And so, I mean, wouldn't that be nice? Right?
It sure would, especially in, as you know so well, because you've been at the pointy end of the spear on all of this. The costs to our society have been so staggering. It's not just the human, you know, suffering and loss of life and so on. It's America, as we've known it, has really been on the ropes as a result of all of this, to the point where I think many of us are really concerned that there may be irreparable harm done now to our freedoms. The question that is kind of implied by your statement that it's safe to get in the water again, in a manner of speaking, is will we in fact get our freedoms back? Or as I have to tell you, as somebody who spends a lot of time worrying about communist China, will we find ourselves endlessly subjected to this idea that, well, there's something else coming and we have to follow the China model of dealing with these kinds of diseases, including what they call in China, as I'm sure you're aware, the social credit system, as a means of essentially imposing this vaccine passport, as well as the rest of their sort of oppressive tyranny on the rest of us. I pray it's not going that way, but this makes all the more urgent people hearing and heeding your recommendation that we're out of the woods, or nearly out of the woods, and certainly don't need to persist in this kind of Chinese program. Have I got that right?
The question is, are we going to build an entire social credit system and emergency response and everything over a stuffy nose? I mean, that's the real question, is how much angst can we really lather up in a situation where there's Mother Nature's taken the starch out of this illness? I mean, don't forget, it's recombination and natural selection pressures that have basically pummeled this gain of function spike protein down to making it a fairly impotent invading force now. So the question is just the process of getting a cold. Just while we had this interview, I got three more patients came in and said they have, including a doctor, like, what does he need to do? He's kind of panicking. And it sounds like he just has a case of the sniffles. And really? And so I just think at some point in time, are people going to say, you know what, were we kind of duped on this? It's really just a case of the sniffles. Most people can't discern it from you know, allergies or hay fever.
Well, this is the current variant. In fairness, the previous ones were considerably more difficult, but could have been dealt with differently. And that's what you've been recommending. The McCullough Protocol, I think, is one of your very important contributions to all of this. And I just want to, again, commend to our listeners this book, in which you not only can find an enormous amount of information about how to contend with this thing at home through early treatment, if it does, in fact, turn out to be more than sniffles, including recommendations about doctors that you can turn to if your own won't provide, you know, a medical prescription reference for the use of such prescription drugs as may be required. And ivermectin and hydrochloroquine are two that that you have recommended, and that when needed ought to be widely available. It's just maddening that this has been so difficult and so assiduously fought by the people who have, it seems, done the duping, to use your expression, Dr. Peter McCullough.
Well, I wanted to respond to that, though, because I think the first year was the year of hydroxychloroquine. Second year was the year of ivermectin. The third year, if there is any virulence that returns, is going to be the year of Pfizer and Merck. And what I say is, let's see it. I mean, the early treating doctors, we're tired. We haven't taken a day off in 2 years. We can let the other million doctors who have been sitting on the sidelines, they can step forward and prescribe Merck and Pfizer and the other drugs in combination. The interesting thing
is, are the drugs, not the vaccines that you're
right.
Talking about.
The interesting thing is, will they do it? Or will anybody do it at this point in time?
Because so, they might not, because of concerns about testing of them or there's
implications. It may be the same reason why they don't prescribe ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. It may be the same reason. You know, there's never been the same reason why they don't refer patients for monoclonal antibodies.
Dr. Peter McCullough, I know we've got to let you go. I just wanted to ask you one last question. As you have looked back on this process and ways in which we have come to be, and I think duped is the right word, in the course of it, subjected to the denial of our liberties and the imposition of sort of control regimens that, whether they ultimately take the form of the Chinese social credit system or not, you know, please God deliver us from that. And maybe Omicron is the vehicle for doing that, ironically. But the lessons learned here, it seems, would be, among other things, that you need to take the kind of approach that you talked about. You need to have specialists in the field, in small numbers, doing the kind of analytic work in real time and in a very publicly accessible way, not entrusting to some kind of vaccine czar the sole responsibility for guiding the nation on all of this, and in effect dictating political arrangements, not just medical ones. Have I got that basically right?
We should have always had You know, having the task forces wasn't a bad idea. They just never got to task force subcommittees. You know, White House Task Force One, at least they got on TV a couple of times, but they should have organized into the four pillars. I mean, I told America to do that when I testified in the U.S. Senate, and I'm the most authoritative. That was in November 2020. I'm the most authoritative doctor who's had an opinion on COVID-19 in terms of publication track record, publications on COVID-19 and treatment experience and training. And it never was done. And White House Task Force One kind of faded away. And then White House Task Force Two was named, and they never even got together, let alone formed into subcommittees. And, you know, we've been languishing with these low-level kind of government-appointed people who, again, Scott Atlas characterized, was his words, not mine. He said they're grossly incompetent. You know that because there's no analysis of data. There's no organization. Doctors always work in teams. There's no organization. They're implying basically no competent organized response to the pandemic.
And I have to just say in closing that the fact that one of those low level, I would say low quality, perhaps high level individuals, Dr. Tony Fauci, was complicit in helping bring about all of this engineering of the virus, it makes this scandal, this duping, even more outrageous. And I hope that at the end of the day, sir, that not only will that all come out and be understood and responded to appropriately by the American, the extraordinary service that you have rendered with your colleagues and others who have been responsible, among other things, for this guide to home-based COVID treatment will be given their due. And I want to just say again, thank you from this one American, speaking for a lot of others, for your service to our country, sir. And I hope you'll keep it up, and I do hope you'll come back to us with updates if you would. Meantime, God bless you, sir. Thank you.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Dr. Peter McCullough is one of the world's most influential physicians. Sunday he'll address a march in Washington. Tonight, he gives Secure Freedom Radio his prescription for our country. Quote, I think at this point in time, we go ahead and drop all the vaccine mandates. We can make things very easy for the Supreme Court and the Biden administration. And then we pull the vaccines off the market. Pfizer, J&J, and Moderna. Pull them. Do a review on safety. Figure out what went wrong. Why did they fail against the variants? And then, if an occasional sick Omicron patient comes up, they'll be early treated with available therapy. They're very treatment responsive. And then we go back to normal. Now we can stop all the emergency measures, stop all the masks, lockdowns, social distancing, stop all that. Just return to normal now, unquote. Amen. This is Frank Gaffney.